WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. When the Soviets launched Sputnik into orbit in 1957, NASA didn't exist, and Chris Kraft was an engineer testing military aircraft. He had no expertise in rocketry or even basic astronomy. Nonetheless, Chris Kraft was tapped as a member of the original Space Task Group in charge of NASA's first major program, the Mercury missions. Kraft directed the first rocket launches, created mission control in Cape Canaveral, and was the flight director for all the Mercury missions, some of the Gemini missions, and director of flight operations through most of the Apollo program. Besides the astronauts, Kraft was one of NASA's better-known personalities at the heyday of the space program. He was the man in headphones at Mission Control, the last stop in the chain of command that either gave the go-ahead to launch or to abort a flight. Kraft has a new memoir, Flight: My Life in Mission Control. In it, he writes that early on in the space program, one of the most basic tasks he faced turned out to be one of the most challenging. He had to build a countdown to liftoff.
Well, when you think about it, the number of pieces of equipment in a missile range, for instance, the cameras, the telemetry system, the communication system, all of the support activities, and then you add to that the rocket, the spacecraft, preparing the human being to get ready to go. The various remote sites across the world that had to be involved. And so if you're going to bring all this thing to T-zero and make sure that everything is working to the best of your ability at that particular moment, now to ensure that that's going to take place, you want to make sure that everybody runs a test, everybody says what I've got is working and it's doing well and I'm ready to go. When you stop to think about that, there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of pieces of this thing that have to do something to say, yes, I'm ready to go at a certain time. So when you start building these programs, these tests, and that's what we eventually call a countdown, for each one of these pieces of equipment, for each one of these areas, for the launch pad, for the spacecraft, for the guys that are getting the astronaut ready, when do they have to start? When do you have to run this test? How much training do you have to do, et cetera? That's what makes a countdown so extremely complicated. It just a single countdown for a given piece of equipment, like a camera, that's a long-range camera looking at the rocket being launched. The guy goes through these tests. Does the camera run? Is the power there? Will it take a picture? And if it does, can I see through the clouds, et cetera? But now expand that by a factor of 1,000, if you will. And everybody's writing a countdown for each one of those things. Now you can see how complex that gets to be.
In the process of designing the first Mercury mission, 7 men were chosen from a pool of active duty military test pilots to be the astronauts. I don't believe there was the term astronaut yet. When John Glenn was one of the active duty military test pilots chosen to be an astronaut, you already knew him. You had a few run-ins with him when he was a Marine major, and you were working at Langley testing airplanes. What was your beef with him?
When you're the lead pilot, which he was in the Navy Bureau of Aeronautics for a particular high-performance airplane, in this case the F-8U, which was one of the Navy's first supersonic fighters. It's your baby, and so you don't think it's much wrong with it, and you don't like to hear people saying there's something wrong with it. That was his job. My job was to run the flying qualities of that airplane, and if it had something wrong with it, point that out to the Navy so they could make it a better airplane. That was our job. I found a lot of things wrong with it. That their test pilots, who were company test pilots, knew about but weren't making any issue of. I was making an issue of them because I wanted to make the airplane better and safer to fly. And so I had a lot of convincing to do every time I told them that their airplane wasn't as good and perfect as they thought it was.
You refer to his, I believe it's the word is gyrene stubbornness?
Yes, yes.
I had to look that one up.
You know, pilots have a tough time dealing with flight test engineers anyway. If you read Yeager's book, he said, those damn guys at NACA talked a language I didn't even understand. But very true. When I told him that the PB over 2V of his airplane was 0.07 and it should be 0.08, he didn't know what the hell I was talking about. Mm-hmm. And I understand that. That's fine. But it was a way for me to describe the fact that the airplane didn't roll fast enough. It wasn't that. It was just that we were at odds back in those days when he was doing that task. So I knew him before he got to be what eventually was called an astronaut. So we had that background with each other. And I think he eventually had a lot of respect for me, and I had a lot of respect for him.
Now, May 5th, 1961 was the first Mercury mission, and there's a wonderful photo in the book of Alan Shepard in his space suit looking up at the Freedom 7 rocket before he boarded. The story that everyone remembers about that first mission is that Shepard's biggest problem, at least on the launch pad, was his bladder.
Yes.
He was in the capsule for 4 hours, and he needed to go. And I assume he told you that you were in on this conversation in flight control, right? That he couldn't, you would not permit him out. That just wasn't possible. Had you
That's
anticipated
correct.
This issue, the need to go?
Yes, we had anticipated it, but we hadn't done anything about it. We had been working on a urine collection device, UCD we called it, but we didn't have it perfected for that flight. We also didn't expect him to be in the spacecraft for as long as he had to be before we launched. We got into problems with the weather. We got in problems with the spacecraft. We got a number of problems with the rocket, so that by the time we got around to getting ready to start the final part of the countdown, he'd been in there a long time. And as you well know, when the adrenaline is flowing, and it was flowing that morning, then you have to pee. And so he said, I've got to urinate. And he said, can I get out? Because we were in a hold. And now that would have really buggered things up because we'd have had to open the spacecraft, had to get him out of there and let him go and then get him back in. So we'd have had to restart the countdown at something like T-minus 2.5 hours. So rather than do that, we said, go in your pants. And he did. And the flow of oxygen dried it up pretty quickly. The next flight, we did have our UCD for Gus Grissom. It was something that you could attach to the penis and pee.
You write in your book that at the start of the countdown for that first mission, you were shaking so hard you couldn't see your microphone. And it made me think of something Gene Kranz, a later flight director, once said, that he described launch as an existential moment. It's like combat. What are those seconds like for you?
This was the first time that we had a man on the end of a rocket. Nobody had ever done that before. Mr. Shepard's, and you said when we started the countdown, it wasn't there. You never got serious about any countdown until you got to T-minus 2 minutes. That's when you knew, when you went past that point, you damn well better get ready to launch. But now, at that time, Shepard's heart rate was about 220. I don't know what mine was, but later flights said mine was about 180. If you don't realize that this is dangerous, that something bad can happen a lot of the time, and that this is the first time that a man is going to be the end of a damn rocket, and you're not shaken, you damn well don't understand the problem.
Now, in the second manned flight, Gus Grissom was the astronaut, and everything went off pretty much fine except for the splash landing. Somehow the hatch blew off prematurely. The capsule sank, and Grissom had a tough time of it staying afloat. NASA never really did find out what exactly happened, and there have been two camps. Some thought Grissom panicked and hit the hatch detonator, and others thought that it was some unknown malfunction. After all the investigations into this, what did you think went wrong?
I believe Gus. When Gus said, I didn't hit the button, that damn thing blew off by itself, and the first thing I saw was water coming over the sill, I said, that is 100% correct.
You thought that then, and you think this now?
I thought that then, and I think it 10 years, 20 years, and I will always think that. Gus was a superb test pilot, maybe one of the best, if not the best. And there was no question in my mind he told us what happened. I think a lot of people couldn't figure out how in the world that could happen because in all the tests we ran after that, we couldn't make it happen. We shook the thing, we hit on it, we did everything we could, and we couldn't make it go off inadvertently. But Gus said it went that way, and I believed him. I still believe him.
Chris Kraft was NASA's first flight director. He directed the first manned missions into orbit and oversaw the Apollo mission to the moon. His new memoir is Flight, My Life in Mission Control. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is NASA's first flight director, Chris Kraft. He helped develop NASA's space program from its earliest days. His new memoir is Flight, My Life in Mission Control. I'd like to back up a little bit to back to 1962, to John Glenn's first flight. There was a problem with his flight. There was a question whether the heat shield was loose or not. And if it was loose, the capsule would ignite on reentry. Could you describe the scene in Mission Control and what your options were for that flight?
Yes. When the spacecraft flew over the Cape on the second time, there was a telemetry signal, radio signal coming down from the spacecraft that said the spacecraft heat shield was loose. And that came from a measurement of a small switch which moved when the heat shield actually loosened up and then dropped free down about 3 or 4 feet, and there was a bag there which acted as a impact alleviation device when it hit the water. I heard that problem as it was presented to me. He said, we see this signal. And I said, well, we haven't had any noises. Glenn hasn't reported anything from the spacecraft. He hadn't heard any noises of the space of the heat shield being loose. We haven't had any problems controlling the spacecraft in terms of anything bouncing around. It's got to be a false signal.
So you had a gut sense that this
I was absolutely convinced in my mind that it was a false signal. And that's not unusual in a instrumented system. Many times the thing you're trying to use to measure it fails. Not unusual in any, as an engineer, common occurrence. So I thought to myself, and I confirmed that by talking to my other engineers, and I talked to Alan Shepard about it, as a matter of fact. And we all concluded that's erroneous. Now, in comes the chief designer, and in comes my boss, and he's listening to the two chief designers, one from McDonnell, one from NASA. And they're saying, well, we think it probably is wrong also. But what if it isn't? And so I listened to those arguments. And they said, well, if we keep the retropack on, the straps that hold the retropack will maybe hold the heat shield up tight against the spacecraft, at least until it gets into the sensible atmosphere, and then the atmosphere will keep it there. That might be a better chance and a better thing to do in case in the 1/10 of 1% case that it might be right. So I listened to those arguments, and I said, I don't think so. Then my boss said to me, but I think that it's still a good thing to do, so do it. I didn't like that direction, but he was my boss at the time, and we left it on. That was a damn bad thing to do, because the reason I didn't want to do it is because you could have gotten a mock cone coming off of that heat that retro pack that was still there and burn a hole in the heat shield. And that was what worried the hell out of me, because we'd had something like that happen before. So after that was all over, I'll tell you what I said. I know a hell of a lot more about this thing than they know. I've got a lot better engineers telling me what's going on than they have. And the next time they tell me to do something, they better think twice about it, because I ain't going to do it unless I'm convinced it's the right thing to do.
When you first heard of President Jack Kennedy's goal of landing a man on the moon, was the moon your first choice, or did you have other ideas?
I didn't have any ideas at the moment, because I was so embroiled in putting a man in orbit around the Earth for the United States for the first time, that what the next project was or where the new goals were going to be was beyond my pay grade. It was my responsibility to get that thing done and done well and bring the astronaut back safely and then measure what we had done. So when Mr. Kennedy said, we choose to go to the moon in this decade, frankly, it was beyond my comprehension. I didn't know what we had to do that. And the magnitude of doing that was so great, I had no idea how big that job was. I just knew that it was something that was totally beyond my ability to cope with the problems that might come up as a result of that. And I was proven right, too, because the problems almost became infinite to do that job compared to flying a man in orbit around the Earth three times and recovering in the ocean.
Now, a month before the first Apollo mission, during a checkout flight, a fire broke out in the spacecraft at Cape Canaveral that was manned by Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee. You were in mission control in Houston.
Yes.
What was your experience in Houston during that crisis?
Well, I was sick in the stomach. I was about as stunned as I've ever been in my life before or since. It took 2 or 3 minutes to realize that you just killed 3 men.
When did you first know something had gone wrong? What did you hear in your headphones, or what alerted you?
I heard some screaming. I heard some confused people on the launch pad external to the spacecraft. I heard a voice with which I was very familiar say, we're on fire. And I heard another voice which I was very familiar with saying, get me out of here. And then I heard silence. And then I heard people scurrying about. And I was afraid to ask. And when I did ask, I got the answer I knew I was going to get and didn't ever want to hear.
Was there anything that could have been done to get the astronauts out?
In that spacecraft, it took at a minimum 2-3 minutes for an astronaut to turn around in his seat, crank a crank, which opened the hatch. And by that time, under these circumstances, where they were probably dead within a few seconds, there was nothing anybody could do.
How did the fire start?
started by we never really knew exactly what happened because most of the wiring in the area where the fire did start, which was below Gus Grissom's couch on the left side, was burned up. But almost certainly there was a bare wire there, and almost certainly there was a spark, and that's all it took. If you take a piece of aluminum and put it at 16 pounds per square inch of oxygen, which is about five times the amount of oxygen I'm breathing right here, and there's no other gas there but oxygen. If you take a piece of aluminum and put a flame to it, the aluminum will immediately burn. Some of the things in the spacecraft that under that kind of oxygen, pure oxygen at that pressure, literally exploded. And some of them put off toxic gas.
Chris Kraft's memoir of his decades as flight director at NASA's Mission Control is Flight. We'll continue our conversation in the second half of our show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's continue our interview with NASA's first flight director, Chris Kraft. He helped design the space program from the ground up, directed NASA's first rocket launches, and helped create Mission Control. He was the director for all of the Mercury missions, some of the Gemini flights, and oversaw operations during the Apollo missions. When we left off, we were talking about the 1967 fire that killed three astronauts, Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee, during a test exercise for the first Apollo mission. Now, you write that that fire was the reason that future Apollo missions were a success, that you owe it to that tragedy. How so?
I think that the whole team of government and industry were running as fast as they could to get to the moon. And I think as a result, they were ignoring lessons learned from space flights that had taken place previously. They were making what they considered to be considered judgments. And remember, anything is a compromise when you make engineering machines from engineering design. And so they were running so fast, and they thought that that goal was so important that they did things which were less than the best. And under their judgment, that was acceptable. After the fire, it was totally unacceptable. And as a result, the pause that we had to take to prove what happened, to understand what happened, to fix that environment so it wasn't there anymore, and to make modifications to the spacecraft in many, many critical areas. We were able to do that in the hiatus that took place after that. And without those modifications, we would have been a long time getting there, because I think we would have experienced a heck of a lot more failures and probably killed more people in space as a result. That's the reason I think it was, unfortunately, the catalyst that made it happen properly. And by the way, you certainly didn't have any trouble getting people's attention after that.
I'm talking with Chris Kraft. He was NASA's first flight director, and perhaps one of NASA's best-known personalities in the early days of the space program. He has a new memoir, Flight, My Life in Mission Control. Getting to the moon, there were a number of concepts on how to do it. Looking back now on the one you eventually settled on, does it seem ludicrous, the lunar module idea? Or you look back and think, what the hell were we thinking?
No, on the contrary. I think that very rapidly I came to the conclusion that that was the only way to do it. You know, when you if you go look at the Saturn V rocket today, lying on its side like it is at the Johnson Space Center here in Houston, That thing is 300 feet long, and you look at the small capsule up on top where the three men flew, and they're 300 feet above ground level. I'd like to take a test, a airline pilot from a 747 and put him on top of that and say, now land that vertically on the earth. How do you what kind of answer do you think you'd get? You'd say that you've lost your mind. So I think that was immediately to my idea was talking at a bug, a small thing that looked like the size of a small helicopter, and landing that on the moon sounded to me like a heck of a lot better problem to deal with than trying to land a Saturn V on the moon.
It's interesting, getting back to the lunar landing, how you describe the landing, that it's also not at all like it is in the movies, and that it was hair-raising for you to watch it in Mission Control. What do we not know about it?
Well, let me explain that in several different ways. If you're an airplane pilot today landing at a normal airport, as you make the approach, you see a tree, you see a house, you see a road, you see a human being, and you know how big they are, right? That means that you have some idea and perspective of where you're going and how fast you're getting there. Now put yourself on the moon. It's full of boulders, it's full of craters, and you have the slightest idea how big they are. You don't know whether that crater as you approach is 3 feet in diameter or 300 feet in diameter. You don't know whether that rock you're looking at is 10 feet high or 100 feet high. You do when you get there, but as you make your approach, you have nothing as a reference. So landing on the moon, the first time, even the second time or third time, it still got that problem. Now, one thing you had going for you was shadows. Okay? So that was the reason we had a launch window, was to make sure that the sun angle was between about 7 and 12 degrees, because that at least, as you approach the moon, you could see these shadows of a big rock or a crater, or the rim of a crater. So that did help a lot. But even so, until you were very close, you couldn't tell how big things were. So your ability to have a reference was very poor.
Now, evidently, there was some question whether there would be a television camera on for the lunar landing. How close did you come to not televising it?
Well, as long as I was there, not very close. I know that sounds funny, but let me go back and be a little more realistic. When we were designing the lunar module, every ounce that we put on that spacecraft was important to us, because we couldn't afford to have this thing overweight. Because the heavier it got, the more fuel it took, and the less margin we had. So we were battling and battling every day to reduce the weight. We made the landing gears thinner. We made the wires so thin it would was hard to work with. We made the hatch thin. We made no seats in there for them to sit down on, no place for them to hang a hammock, hardly, if they were going to sleep in there, et cetera, et cetera. Every piece of paper we put on there had to go through a configuration control board because it weighed something. So in that context, the bosses of the design said, are we going to take a television camera? Because the camera and the transmission equipment is probably going to cost us 10 to 15 pounds. And 10 to 15 pounds was a heck of a lot of weight at that point in time. Now, the other side of that coin is, you mean to tell me that you're going to go land men on the moon for the first time and you're not going to be able to see it happen? You mean to tell me that all these people in this United States who paid their money, we've been telling them about this for the last 8-9 years, and you're going to tell them you don't have a television camera on board? You got to be kidding me.
So that was the case you made.
That's the case I made. And besides that, I want to see it happen.
You write that you envied the astronauts, that after so many years planning to get a man on the moon, did you wish you weren't staying behind on the ground?
Be perfectly honest, No. I never wanted to go.
Why not?
Because I was on every flight. Vicariously, I was on every flight. They only got to fly once. I got to fly every time they went.
Do you think you could do it? Sit there 43 stories up on top of all that explosive material?
Not without being anesthetized.
Knowing what you know.
You got that right. I mean, if you don't think that lighting up millions of pounds of thrust, burning millions of pounds of propellant every few seconds is dangerous, you don't understand the problem. And that's true today when they fly the space shuttle like it was when we flew Alan Shepard on the Redstone rocket.
Chris Kraft, I'd like to thank you very much for joining me on Fresh Air.
Real pleasure.
Chris Kraft is the former director of NASA's Lyndon B. Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. His new memoir is Flight, My Life in Mission Control. This is Fresh Air.